What's causing the autism epidemic in America's children?
Much of the research until now has focused on trying to find a genetic cause for autism, but all the research so far combined has only explained about 15% of autism cases through genetics. So while they know there's a strong genetic component, they also know something else has to be going on, and that's where these environmental toxins are coming into play.
That's Britta Belli. We'll talk with her about her book, The Autism Puzzle, connecting the dots between environmental toxins and rising autism rates. And it's not just autism. It's also cancer and other diseases. We air our 2008 interview with journalist Nancy Nichols about her memoir, Lake Effect, Two Sisters and a Town's Toxic Legacy. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. More than 80,000 chemicals are registered for use in the U.S. Each year, around 2,000 new ones are put into use. They go into everyday items like foods, personal care products, prescription drugs, household cleaners, and lawn care products. Only about 300 have been tested for human safety. That could be set to change. On July 25th, a Senate committee on the environment voted to let the Safe Chemicals Act go to the Senate floor for a vote. Here's why the act is so important. Right now, a chemical has to be proven harmful before it can be banned. And that's incredibly hard to do. We're exposed to so many chemicals, it's difficult to prove a cluster of cancer cases, or autism cases, is due to any specific chemical. The Safe Chemicals Act would reverse the burden of proof. If passed, it would mean a chemical would have to be proven safe before being used. My guest, Britta Belli, shines a light into one major corner of the impact of toxic chemicals on our health, the role they may play in the explosive rise in autism among American children. Her book, The Autism Puzzle, explores why autism has gone from a rare disease to now affecting 1 in 88 children. It's gone up 78% just in the past decade. The Autism Puzzle follows three families with autistic children and also takes a wider look at the chemicals that may be putting our children at risk. Britta Belli is editor of E, the environmental magazine. Britta Belli, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
I was so glad to see your book, The Autism Puzzle, come out, because for a long time I found myself screaming at the radio or the TV when I hear reports that never seem to mention the role that environmental toxins must be playing in the incredible rise in the rates of autism recently. Could you first give us a lay of the land? Tell us what is going on with autism.
Well, the rates are, continue to climb. So it's becoming, really an increasing concern that something's, causing autism rates to go up, and we really haven't figured out what yet. So that's why, researchers are beginning to branch out and to look for other explanations. Much of the research until now has focused on looking at genetics and trying to find a genetic cause for autism. But all the research so far combined has only explained about 15% of autism cases through genetics. So while they know there's a strong genetic component, they also know something else has to be going on. And that's where these environmental toxins are coming into play. And researchers are beginning to look into that and finding connections between a lot of these things, these chemicals that we're exposed to on a regular basis that they know are building up in our bodies and impacting people who may have a genetic predisposition towards autism. But this is sort of tipping the balance, these various exposures that could be happening from the food we eat, the air we breathe, and the water we're drinking, kind of everyday exposures.
A lot of people say, well, it's just that autism is being more reported. Generally, this is what I hear. We don't know why these are going up, but it could be just because the reporting rate is going up.
Well, autism is definitely better understood than it used to be. There's more recognition of it. There's it's certainly being better diagnosed, but that still doesn't explain the climb, the increase entirely. And as one of the researchers I spoke to said, if it were just a matter of better diagnosis, there would be a lot more adults and older individuals stepping forward who had been misdiagnosed in the past But that isn't what they're seeing. What they're seeing is really just an increase in children who have autism. So there's something significant that's going on, and that's increasing, and that's new, and that we still haven't sort of gotten to the bottom of what that is. But the signs all seem to be pointing now to these chemical exposures.
You just said before a genetic predisposition. Explain a little bit, first of all, why can't autism be entirely explained by genetics? And what is the role, just to follow up on that, of epigenetics? Explain what that is and how that might tease out some of this genetic environmental connection.
Well, in some cases, it can be explained entirely by genetics. Not every autism case is being caused, but, you know, it has the same cause. So it varies from individual to individual. With identical twins, for instance, there's a very high percentage rate of identical twins who would both have autism. The severity of it is not always the same, though. So once again, you're seeing something that's not entirely genetic. So, you know, if two identical twins have autism, but it's a different severity, that means something else is at play that's causing it to be greater in one than in the other. Epigenetics, it literally means over or above genetics. It's something that influences the way our genes are expressed, but doesn't change the gene itself. So things that have an epigenetic impact on us could be anything from, you know, smoking and drinking, to our diets, to environmental exposures, to, you know, various chemicals or toxins, heavy metals like mercury, these chemicals in plastics like bisphenol A and phthalates. So the thought is that many of these exposures may have an epigenetic impact. And by changing the way our genes are expressed, this can also be passed down from generation to generation. It's like a subtle way that we may be shifting the way our genes are being expressed and then passing it on from generation to generation. And that could help explain why autism rates continue to grow year after year.
So you're saying that to some degree, some people might be more sensitive, but then once the gene has been expressed a certain way, it can actually be passed on to offspring? Could you give us an example of that?
Sure. In the past, it was, you know, certain studies that they've done, they found that, like, if people had to go through, like, a period of time where they were essentially starving, they were not being given enough food, that their offspring would, generations later, their children and or grandchildren would be more prone to obesity. And what they realized was that connecting this period of starvation and the later generation being prone to obesity was that it was essentially their cells were being told to sort of hang on to glucose wherever they could find it. So they were being almost like programmed. It's a way of thinking of like programming the cells. And that was something that had been passed on as a result of that period of starvation. So it's something that an experience that you live through could actually impact the way your genes are expressed, you know, for your children that when you're pregnant, and then could literally get passed down from generation to generation.
So you just mentioned a number of chemicals, bisphenol A and phthalates. They've been in the news as being chemicals that babies are exposed to. They've been found in cord blood of, you know, some enormous percentage of newborn infants. Are these the chemicals of concern?
Those are two. I mean, bisphenol A and there's are part of a range of chemicals known as endocrine disrupting or, you know, the hormone disrupting chemicals. And there's a whole range of these. They include phthalates, which are found in vinyl flooring and hairspray, nail polish. Bisphenol A is found in canned food, most canned food, plastic containers, cash register receipts. There's many pesticides that also disrupt the way the hormones work in the body. Flame retardants, which we find in, you know, furniture, computers, and even, you know, crib mattresses, that kind of thing. So many of these different chemicals have the same mechanism, which is that they interrupt the way the body either produces or processes hormones. And it's believed now that many of these can have autism-like impacts in children when moms are exposed when they're carrying their babies. So, you know, and exposures can happen in so many different ways. And I think and they can also interact with each other as you get more than one exposure happening from more than one place.
Autism is something that occurs in the brain. What's the connection between autism and the endocrine system?
Well, they're actually connected, and it's so much of autism is like has to do with, it's really like a difficulty in socializing and trusting and interacting socially, and that is directly tied to the body's hormones. And the endocrine and the nervous system are directly connected. So the endocrine system is made up of glands and hormones, and it works directly with the nervous system, in which the neurons in the brain send messages to the rest of the body. So it's called the neuroendocrine system, and these two systems, you know, really work in concert in the body. And it's now thought that, you know, hormone production is directly tied to brain development, and any alteration in that as a baby is developing, as the brain is developing in the mother's womb, can have long-lasting impacts on how a child will later learn and socialize and learn to trust and all of these things.
Well, Britta Bella, you also, in the autism puzzle, you make a connection between ADHD. Talk about this. What is, in what way can, are they perhaps akin to each other or close to each other? What is exactly the biological mechanism here?
Well, they can both express with similar symptoms. I mean, both ADHD and autism. I mean, certain things such as impulsivity, hyperactivity, you know, you often see with both children ADHD and children with autism. The differences are the social and language difficulties, which are really kind of specific to autism. And it's also shown that, like, the way you treat the two disorders is different. But there can often be this sort of overlap when it comes to that, the hyperactive behaviors and the impulsive behaviors. So many of these kind of chemical reactions to chemicals, it seems, can be expressed as either ADHD or autism or both, or, you know, difficulties that are seen in both cases. So could it be that you know, the timing of the exposure could make a difference? I mean, it's not clear yet what's, you know, but we know that, like, say, pesticide exposure has been tied to higher autism rates in communities, the more the exposure to pesticides, and has also been tied to ADHD and other research. So we're seeing that the same chemicals of concern are having different impacts through various studies.
So you've mentioned some chemicals of concern, the endocrine disruptors. There's also been talk about vaccines. Of course, that was the huge controversy. Many parents of autistic kids have said that their kids became autistic after getting this enormous battery of vaccines that kids get nowadays, way up from what was going on when I was a kid, much less my son. What do you think about the vaccine debate?
To me, it's really, you know, time to move beyond it. I absolutely understand parents' concern. I think there's a couple things at play there. One was the concern about mercury, which is a very valid concern in relation to autism, and is certainly being studied in relation to autism. But mercury exposure is not coming from vaccines. It's primarily coming from fish and from dental fillings at this point. Those are the two major sources of our mercury exposure. And we are seeing a lot of connection in studies between mercury exposure and autism, and also specifically the way children with autism have difficulty processing heavy metals. So they're building up to more dangerous levels inside their bodies. And they know this because they've looked at the baby hair and baby teeth of children with autism, and they're seeing to study, like, how much is remaining in the body and finding that their levels are much higher. And studies have shown, say, in Texas, that for every 1,000 pounds of environmentally released mercury, there's a 61% increase in a community's rate of autism. So on various levels, they're looking at this mercury-autism connection. But in terms of vaccines, it was Thimerosal was the preservative that was contained mercury. You know, that's been removed from the vast majority of childhood vaccines since 2001, and yet autism rates have continued to go up. They've been studied. There's been no connection found. So I think it absolutely makes sense for parents to be concerned. And I know it's particularly difficult for those parents whose children have regressive autism, the autism that comes on about, you know, 18 months of age. The child seemed to be developing normally and suddenly has this terrible regression, and it's, I mean, you know, obviously very frightening for parents. It happens in about 25% of autism cases, and when that seems to coincide with about the time they're receiving the vaccines, it's, you know, obviously frightening and understandable that parents are looking for some kind of answer.
Well, doesn't that seem to point to something like that? I mean, why would the autism come on late like that?
I mean, and unfortunately, that's just the way some cases of autism manifest. Just like you might have people develop allergies or asthma at a certain point in life, it's no different. It's just, it does, you know, because of the timing of it, people are making that association. But as I said, no connection has ever been found between that and vaccines. It's been studied exhaustively. And of course, the one researcher, Andrew Wakefield, who made that connection, found to have falsified his research and has been discredited. So as I say in the book, it's not wrong that parents are looking at these exposures. They've just maybe been looking in the wrong places for them. And so I talk a lot about mercury in the book, but mercury from specifically from power plants, from coal-burning power plants that has then contaminated our environment and contaminated our bodies. I mean, we know that women's mercury levels in their blood has been on the rise. I mean, every time they do these studies, and it's pretty shocking, really. I mean, it was 1999, 2% of women 18 to 49 had detectable levels of mercury in their blood. By 2005, 30% of women in that age group had detectable levels of mercury. This is something that builds up in the environment and that we're all exposed to. And they're testing newborn cord blood and finding mercury in 100% of the cord blood samples they're testing. So I think we have a serious problem with mercury and with our environmental exposures, and has really gotten out of control.
And what about the levels? I mean, it doesn't take a whole lot to create these kinds of effects on the endocrine system. Is that right?
Right. It's really looking at these critical windows of development. So, you know, it might be during the second trimester or the third trimester, but really a drop in an Olympic-sized pool, was how one researcher put it, is all it takes. I mean, to seriously change the way the brain is developing and the way the child will later learn and socialize. So these exposures are of most concern when women are pregnant and of course there's advisories about fish, there's, you know, about eating tuna. But I think really it's almost not enough because you really don't know from how much mercury is in that can of tuna that you're eating. I mean, it's not something that's going to tell you on the can, you know. So and that exposure could be happening also along with other exposures that you're not even aware of, from your nail polish and your hairspray and your from the soup that you're eating and the pesticides are on the fruits and vegetables. So I mean, there's so many different places that these exposures are happening. One of the things that I really bring up is the need for a serious overhaul of our chemical legislation, which is just severely outdated. I mean, the Toxic Substances Control Act, which is still the governing chemicals in this country, was passed in 1976 and grandfathered in 61,000 chemicals. I mean, so essentially that has meant that these chemicals do not have to prove that they're safe, even to pregnant women and to children, and they're allowed to be kind of circulated freely. And we're not, unless in a sense that there's some data showing that they're unsafe, the government can't require any new testing of them. And, you know, none of this kind of safety data exists. So it's kind of a catch-22. And for a long time now, for years, there's been the introduction of the Safe Chemicals Act. And there's a building momentum now with a lot of consumer and health groups, environmental groups, trying to really build consumer awareness of this issue and to pass new legislation that says, all right, we've all got to start from the same point, and every chemical has to be, has to have safety testing, has to prove that it's safe, or has to be replaced with a safer alternative.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Britta Belli about her book, The Autism Puzzle. That's how the European Union does it. It's called the precautionary principle.
Right, exactly. And then the EU has passed what's called the REACH legislation, and it's essentially the same thing as what the Safe Chemicals Act would do. And it's already been passed, and it's being phased in, and will be completely phased in by 2018. So I think what's really unfortunate here is that, you know, it puts the U.S. in the position of kind of falling behind and also allowing companies to sell us products that they're not even allowed to sell in Europe. You know, so we're allowing ourselves to be, you know, the consumers of the unsafe products, while companies are forced to manufacture new products for Europe, who has set stronger safety standards. So I think we don't want to be the dumping ground for, you know, toxic products. and really like kind of open that door for, I mean, there are safer alternatives, and there's a whole field called green chemistry where they're developing safer chemicals that break down safely in the environment and in the body and that don't have these impacts. You know, and we're seeing so many things in addition to autism on the rise, or whether it's allergies and asthma and cancer. I mean, we're, you know, rates of so many things that are going up simultaneously that have all individually been tied to these chemical exposures. That it's really in kind of a crisis mode at this point.
You talk about, I mean, that crisis has really come home to certain areas of the country. You talk about autism clusters, one in Spring, Texas, another in Brick, New Jersey. And what I found so distressing in reading this in your book, Britta Belli, The Autism Puzzle, was how the EPA, you know, those government agencies that are in charge of taking care of the public health, how they seem to minimize what's going on. And in fact, you cite a study that's called Inconclusive by Design. Talk about how the government is failing to protect us and why.
You know, this is the Gallagher family. I looked at three different families. This is the family in Brick, New Jersey. They have two children with autism, very close in age, who are now like 17 and 18 years old, a boy and a girl, with severe autism. And that mom had, you know, realized as she started going to support groups that there were quite a few families born the same year as her children coming with you know, the same thing, you know, who also had children with autism. And she said, you know, what's going on here? So eventually an investigation was launched, and the Center for Disease Control came in, the ATSDR, which is the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, and they came in and I mean, really didn't give it the comprehensive type of study that the families really felt it deserved. You know, they really felt that there was something going on, but the results were, you know, essentially, as so often happens, were inconclusive. This being said, they did not test the household water supplies. They didn't take any blood and urine samples, didn't test the dust in the homes or anything else. So they gathered some data from the water company, because in this case, the concern was really about the local water supply. You know, came up with some reports, had everybody gather in the library and read them the report, and then sent them home. And really, it was very disheartening. It was a very disheartening process for the parents involved. And it turns out that this is very typical of the way these issues are handled. They're almost always found to be inconclusive. For the most part, the sampling size is considered too small. So often when I talk even to researchers, they say to me, well, you know, we found this connection between this chemical and autism, but it's not enough to say that this is really causing it because it's too small of a sample. You know, so unless you have a truly large, comprehensive study with 100,000 people, you know, you can't really know for sure that this is causing anything. It's just a clue. It's just, you know, there's something going on, but we can't say definitively. And I think that's made it very frustrating. There also is partially seems to be built into this process sort of an unwillingness to find answers, whether that's because, you know, people don't want to spend the money to do the extended research, whether they don't want to create a public health scare. I think all of these kind of play into it, but that has been really challenging. And in the case of the Gallaghers and in Brick, New Jersey, various researchers have taken on that investigation for themselves. So as years have gone by, in their case, they were looking at these byproducts of chlorination in the water. The particular family I spoke to lived like right across the street from the water processing plant, and she said, I mean, she would say to me that the water in their bathtub looked blue at times. I mean, there's definitely something, you know, so she felt there was something going on with the water. Well, these researchers have down the road now, you know, decades later, have actually looked at how these specific chlorination byproducts acting together could impact development, and they have found that there could be autism-like response as a result of exposure to these chemicals. But they've now only, you know, gotten up to animal studies. I mean, so they're kind of going up the ladder with these studies, but once again, you know, is it a definitive answer? I mean, you know, not necessarily, but it's certainly showing that this was not completely off base, that there's something there, something of concern.
And you mentioned, you know, it was a combination of chemicals. Another issue that you talk about in the book, Britta Belli, in your book, The Autism Puzzle, is the problem of synergistic effects, of the fact that, you know, we're in an uncontrolled experiment here. We're not just exposed to BPA or just exposed to phthalates or just exposed to mercury, but to all of these acting together.
Right. I mean, that is the biggest concern with autism. And I heard this again and again, was that no one's expecting to find one silver bullet. Okay, we found that, this is the chemical that's causing autism. It's really thought that it's chemicals acting in combination. And in many cases, these are very difficult to control because our approach to chemicals thus far, unfortunately, has been a very one-by-one approach. So we've seen public awareness and outcry over BPA, for instance, recently. So BPA has been taken out voluntarily, really, from manufacturers out of baby bottles and baby products. And now you go to the store and most things say BPA-free on them, the things for babies. And you see, canned food, Campbell's Soup recently announced that they were going to begin phasing out BPA out of their soup can linings, which is, great. Fantastic. And you're seeing the same thing with phthalates. Various states are passing bans, at least for children's products. So on a one-by-one basis, these chemicals are being recognized and dealt with, but it's because of the concern of the interaction that's happening, the multiple chemicals, the one-by-one approach is not going to be effective enough. What's really needed is this sort of legislative overhaul where we really start from scratch and say, okay, we need to test everything. Everything needs to meet the same safety standards. No grandfathering in. Our knowledge about chemicals has changed so much since 1976. We have such a better understanding that it's not just about dose any longer. It's about the timing of exposure, and that's what we really need to be concerned about. So, right now we're not protecting public health, and our legislation is failing us. So we really need to strengthen it, to start from scratch, and to demand higher standards.
Now, you just recently had a baby. What kind of concerns do you have? What kind of measures are you taking? Legislation will take a long time if it can ever pass a Congress that is in gridlock as it is now. What do you suggest people do? What are you doing?
It is so challenging, and it's interesting. I have a blog, autismandtoxins.com, and I wrote at one point about how, I find myself studying this stuff and then, in a sense, breaking some of these rules, eating tuna fish sandwich while I'm pregnant and I know I shouldn't, or I'm at work and I have, something in a plastic container and I end up microwaving it because we had no bowls that day, that kind of thing. And is this one exposure going to be enough? Is this going to be is this something I shouldn't be doing? It's very easy for parents to just become, paranoid with all this. It's very challenging. Like most parents, I do the best I can. I do try to avoid microwaving in plastic, where possible. And for the most part, I've switched to glass containers, which I think are, easy enough and available. So a lot of the food exposures, I think, are just a good place to start, especially when you're pregnant. Avoiding cooking in nonstick cookware. I feel like I've tended to move beyond the canned soup altogether because of the BPA issue. I find that one really bothers me because you really don't know the level of exposure that you're getting whatsoever. I've switched in many cases to canned salmon as opposed to tuna, which is I found to be a perfectly great alternative and tastes fairly similar and doesn't have as much of the mercury concern.
But then you've got the BPA lining in the can.
Oh, I know. It's just, and it really, this is where you're right. You can't, it is literally impossible to avoid so many of these exposures. So, you worry and you hope and you do the best you can and you buy organic and you check labels. And I have for a long time been really an advocate of the homemade cleaners and not, exposing to a lot of those kinds of, especially, I have a small place and when you're cleaning in the bathroom and that kind of stuff, but where you use the distilled white vinegar and water and, you make your own spray and really avoid some of those kinds of toxic exposures. I think some, just by minimizing the products we're using is one way to go. And certainly airing out the house a lot is really helpful. Because a lot of this is like the off-gassing of, the things you're putting on your pets, on your carpets, if you're painting your walls and all that, that's where you really want to be careful about you making sure that you're getting enough of that air circulation in the home, because that the indoor air is really where things build up, and in the dust in the home. Once again, you do the best you can, and I in no way hope that this book just makes parents paranoid. I think really it should make people a little angry and hopefully get them activated, get them engaged in this discussion about chemical reform. and check out some of the organizations that are working in this area and try to really stay on top of it, because I think there needs to be a serious public pressure to pass this legislation.
Well, we will link to sites about that legislation as well as to your book and your own blog. Britta Belli, this is a terrific book, The Autism Puzzle. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Britta Belli is editor of E! The Environmental Magazine. She blogs about autism and toxins at autismandtoxins.com. Go to saferchemicals.org to find out more about the Safe Chemicals Act and what you can do to support it. Next up, Nancy Nichols talks about her memoir, Lake Effect, Two Sisters and a Town's Toxic Legacy. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In 2008, I spoke with Nancy Nichols about her memoir, Lake Effect. She and her sister both came down with cancers she suspects were caused by the toxic exposures they experienced as children. She survived the cancer. Her sister did not. My next guest has a very personal and tragic story to tell. In 1992, journalist Nancy Nichols found out that her sister, then in her 40s, had just been diagnosed with a rare form of ovarian cancer. On her deathbed, her sister made Nichols promise to write about her illness and what they both thought might be the cause of it: massive pollution in their hometown of Waukegan, Illinois. Waukegan is located on Lake Michigan, and millions of pounds of PCBs and other toxic chemicals were dumped over decades into the lake's waters, contaminated the fish Nichols and her sister ate, the air they breathed, and the water they drank. While working on her sister's story, Nichols got her own diagnosis of a rare form of pancreatic cancer. She was 42. In her book, Lake Effect, Nichols connects her personal story to the larger one of how government and big business prized profits over health, and the journey Nichols traveled to understand why. Well, Nancy Nichols, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you.
Your sister was 41 when she was diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer, and you were diagnosed with cancer when you were 43, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
What made you suspect that your sister's cancer and then yours were caused by the toxic pollution you were both exposed to when you were kids?
Well, it's an interesting story. My sister, when she had ovarian cancer, asked me to write about her illness. In fact, it was a deathbed promise that made me start to really seriously investigate the pollution in our hometown and its possible links with the diseases she had, first endometriosis and then ovarian cancer. And I was about halfway into that book when my own cancer was diagnosed. I had a rare form of pancreatic cancer.
So you both grew up in Waukegan, Illinois. What made you link your cancers to the environment that you grew up in?
There were about 1 million pounds of polychlorinated biphenyls in my hometown. That's a chemical that was used in manufacturing. It's a lubricant. That chemical was banned as a cancer-causing agent by the federal government when I was just leaving high school in the late 1970s, early 1980s. So,
and this is PCBs.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. So it was not there was a million pounds of PCBs on the lake. They were trucked to a landfill half a mile from our house. That landfill bordered the farm where we bought our vegetables. It bordered a restaurant where we ate and nursing home where my grandmother was. Eventually, there would be three Superfund sites in our hometown. It was not a huge leap to start to think about the environment and the cancers that we faced.
When did it dawn on you? How did it dawn on you that there might be an environmental link?
I published my first piece as a journalist in the Chicago Tribune about the problems in my hometown in the early 1980s. I didn't really seriously start to connect them with personal illnesses until my sister was diagnosed in 1992. So it was about then that we started to think, wow, this isn't just an intellectual concern. It isn't a concern that you would have about your hometown. This is something that might personally have affected us.
And you were eight when there was a huge die-off of fish in Lake Michigan.
That die-off of alewives was actually of biblical proportions. They washed ashore in huge numbers. There were literally 2 to 3 feet of dead fish on the beaches. And that happened all along the shores of Lake Michigan.
And what killed them?
And that's a complicated story. There are some people who believe that certainly the toxins in the lake were not helping them. They're fish that actually a saltwater fish, and they're in Lake Michigan, of course, is a freshwater body. So they were unable to adapt to the changes. They're an invasive species, so some combination of toxicity and just maladaptive behavior killed them off.
And then Waukegan decided to stock the lake, to restock it, with coho salmon. Why was that problematic in terms of the problems, the cancers that you and your sister contracted and the general problem of pollution, of exposures to pollution by the people around that area?
That's just such an interesting story about when once you have a sort of disruption in the environment. So we had this invasive species of alewives, and then the states bordering the Great Lakes decided to stock a fish that would actually eat the alewife, so they picked this big, fatty coho salmon. And the idea of fighting one invasive to introduce another invasive, the coho salmon, was actually brilliant and wacky, and it worked. The problem is that the fish became an unbelievably good repository for the chemicals in the lake, so that they became an uninterrupted pathway between the chemicals in the lake bed and dinner plates all along the shores of Lake Michigan.
A little bit about what PCBs do, maybe before we go a little further. You know, we've had our own problems here in Western Massachusetts. General Electric has been charged with polluting towns nearby, actually in the Berkshires or between us and the Berkshires, with PCB pollution. Of course, there's pollution in the Hudson River.
Right.
But for those of our listeners who aren't aware of what the problem is, tell us, what do PCBs do to us?
PCBs are a class of chemicals that are known as endocrine disruptors, which means that they can enter the body and either act like a human hormone or disrupt the function of a human hormone. So they've been known, for example, to accumulate in ovarian fluids. They are sometimes linked with reproductive disorders like infertility. So in my own case, in my sister's case, my sister had a disease called endometriosis, which is a reproductive disorder. I had infertility problems. Many of the things that would have been textbook examples of how PCBs affect, say, wildlife, then would showed up in my family.
You know, back when I was doing work as an environmental health educator, and this must have been in the 90s, studies came across my desk that said that about infertility, that sperm count was falling in men, had in fact fallen by half in the early 1990s over the previous 50 years. And in fact, some researchers thought that if the trend continued, most men would be infertile within the next 50 years. Infertility was a real issue. Tell us a little bit more about that for you.
In my case, it was not an issue with my husband. It was not an issue of sperm count, although I'm familiar with the studies that you're suggesting. In my case, I was able to have one child, but just never able to have another. It's what people call sort of unexplained fertility, but what I write about in my book, Lake Effect, is thinking about, we know, for example, that infertility in birds would increase if they had eaten the fish in the lake, and that also women who have eaten a great deal of Lake Michigan fish had longer, it took them longer to conceive if, in fact, they were able to conceive. So what I did in the book was talk a lot about my personal story, but try to link it to what we know to be the research on women who have eaten Great Lakes fish.
And also an impact on learning disorders.
That I have no personal experience with, and I have to be very grateful for that. My son is quite healthy. But I think that is a major thing that the scientists and public health officials are really concerned about. Many people think it's an epidemic that's linked to toxics like the ones I was exposed to as a child, but also many more chemicals that are prevalent today.
Now, you mentioned endometriosis before. Tell us what that is and tell us what it feels like to have it.
Endometriosis is an extremely painful disease. It gives you very painful periods. And what it is it's when the uterine tissue moves outside the walls of the uterus and perhaps attaches to an ovary or is in that cavity somewhere in your abdominal cavity. And it should not be there. So when you get your period, it swells and sometimes bleeds a tiny bit and causes scarring and can be very painful. And my sister had it, as do many, about 5 million women, I believe, in America have it.
You know, there was another thing that I found particularly affecting among many, many things that you recount in your book, and that was the dilemma, the kind of Hobson's choice you faced around, or that you thought, at least, that you faced around fertility. It was difficult for you to become pregnant with your first child, and a doctor told you that you should take fertility drugs. What was the issue there?
The way it happened was my sister was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and as many of your listeners may know, once your sister is diagnosed with that disease, often the sibling is catapulted into medical treatment at the same time. There were many doctors at the time who thought I should immediately have my ovaries removed because of my sister's diagnosis. I chose not to do that and tried to have a child. Then it took me a very long time to have that child, and people thought that I should try fertility treatments. At the time, and this was in the early 1990s, there was a fair amount of research that the drugs being used at the time could perhaps be connected with ovarian cancer, so that I would have been in this bizarre situation of having to take a drug that might give me ovarian cancer in order to have my child so that I could have my ovaries removed immediately so that I would not get ovarian cancer. And it was an unusual situation, to say the least.
And if you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Nancy Nichols about her book, Lake Effect, Two Sisters and a Town's Toxic Legacy. You know, I wrote a study a long time ago. As I said, I was an environmental health educator, worked on worker health and safety. I wrote a study a long time ago for OSHA during the Carter administration when it was under the direction of Eula Bingham. And OSHA and the EPA were pretty progressive agencies that worked together under the Carter administration. And I remember when Ronald Reagan came in and my study and everything else that people had been working on kind of dropped like a stone from the public consciousness and the consciousness of government itself. Talk about what happened to the EPA with Ann Gorsuch.
that was such a sea change, and I was a young reporter also. My town of Waukegan, Illinois, had a little starring role in that, and that one of the administrators from the EPA had come out and tried to cut a backdoor deal with the polluters in my town. Ultimately, there was a congressional investigation of that woman and of the head of EPA, Ann Gorsuch. Both of them were forced to resign. One of them ultimately did some prison time. I think the interesting thing about that was that they went in and they tried to dismantle the EPA enforcement and were somewhat successful. And certainly it is not the aggressive agency that it was once envisioned to be. And currently, Superfund, which is the federal legislation that would clean up sites like the one in my hometown and the ones you've suggested earlier in Western Mass, it has not been refunded by Congress.
Your book is both a compelling personal story as well as a story of regulatory indifference to these problems. You write about something, you call it the social construction of ignorance. What do you mean by that?
That was a term coined by a man named Robert Proctor. And what he is saying, and what I was saying in the book, is that in the same way we create science so that we can understand certain truths or relationship, we can create ignorance by what we choose to study and what we choose not to study. So in my hometown, for example, there has never been a long-term study of the effects of the chemicals there. And that sort of lack of data, the lack of attention to the data that would have given us information to move forward, either as individuals or on a regulatory front, has been duplicated over and over again in this country. Now, most recently, the Centers for Disease Control had a study of the 43 areas of concern around the Great Lakes, and that study showed increases of incidence of cancer around these degraded environmental areas. Well, instead of releasing the report, a very highly acclaimed scientist was asked to leave the CDC. Eventually, that report did come out, but there is certainly a resistance to documenting and discussing what we know to be the issues around environmental health.
You not only have a compelling personal story in the book, but you also talk about what has been going on in this country around all these issues of environmental regulation. When Reagan came in, regulation went out.
It was a sea change in the Reagan administration. When they came into office, there were two women at the EPA who were very high up. One was Rita Lavelle, and she was head of the Superfund program, which is charged with cleaning up the highly degraded areas that are on the national priorities list. She met with polluters in my hometown in Waukegan and tried to do a backdoor negotiation. It became quite a scandal. Her whole running of the program and the office immediately above her would be Ann Gorsuch, and her ability to run the department was called into question. She got into quite a tussle with Congress, and eventually there was some allegations that she was hiding information, and both of them were removed from office.
So was this a case, Nancy Nichols, of the fox guarding the chicken coop?
It was certainly a case where people who were put into office had tremendous contacts with industry, and many of the people at the time who were serving in the Reagan administration in the EPA came from companies who were polluters who had their own Superfund site issues.
The fisherman comes up, puts his two poles in the sand. He stares out at the sea, just exactly like me. But I've got a book in my hand. We will have caught on to something by the end. But mostly we think about the one that got away.
And I'm speaking with Nancy Nichols about her memoir, Lake Effect, Two Sisters and a Town's Toxic Legacy. You know, there's been a lot of concern growing about the chemical bisphenol A, which is a plasticizer put into plastics to harden them. It's also an endocrine disruptor, and it goes into things like baby bottles and sippy cups. In August, the FDA came out with a draft report saying that at the low levels of exposure, kids were not at risk. Could you talk a little bit about this whole issue of low levels of exposure? Because that's often what we hear. We hear, well, you know, yeah, maybe this chemical has some problems, but people aren't getting enough of it.
I think there are two ways to think about this. One is, you know, it's a dose response issue, so you have to have a whole lot of it to hurt you. So think about aspirin, right? You can take it a little bit every day, and it might help your heart condition, but if you were to take three or four bottles in one day, it would hurt you quite a bit. So that's a dose response, and people have also often thought, or for a long time believed, that chemicals work the same way. So a little bit of something like bisphenol A that you might get in a water bottle simply could not hurt you. There's a new science of low-dose toxicity that says, actually, some of these things are active in very, very small parts, maybe parts per million even. And that is consistent with other things we know about pharmaceuticals. So if any of your listeners, for example, have ever seen anybody use an asthma inhaler, the medicine that they take to breathe, that's effective at a very low dose. So there's been a sea change in the way we think about our exposures to chemicals. So it's no longer necessary for people to have the kind of exposures I would have had in the fish in my hometown, where it was at 77 parts per million, for someone to have a very serious exposure to chemicals. Now what people are concerned about are these tiny little doses that we get each and every day from, in fact, consumer products. And that the interesting thing about the FDA report, and I would encourage people to read, say, Pete Myers on that topic, he believed that the FDA report was very influenced by some of the science that had come out of industry as opposed to the science that would have come out of, say, academia.
And Pete Myers, who is he?
He wrote a book called Our Stolen Future.
Oh, that's right. And that was actually the first kind of crossover book that came into the public, you know, the more popular eye, that was about these endocrine disruptors.
Correct. And he's been widely quoted as being skeptical of the FDA report that says that bisphenol A is actually safe. And I think what the really important thing here for people is, look, you're a mom with a baby bottle, and you're trying to figure out things that are so incredibly complex and turns out to be controversial. But I think in going back to your question about the social construction of ignorance, doubt is our enemy. As consumers, we don't want doubt about our products. We don't want to think, my God, is this baby bottle safe? So we really need to rely on our government to regulate in a way that is fair and precautionary and not overly influenced by industry.
Yeah, you have a great image in the book, Lake Effect. And I'm speaking with Nancy Nichols, the author of Lake Effect. Somebody says something about, you know, if you see a baby floating down a river, you're going to jump in and save it. But if you see hundreds of babies floating down the river, you're going to say, my God, where are all these babies coming from?
Right. I mean, I think that it's possible to say, I mean, and I was influenced by this, too. You know, I think I thought, oh, my God, my sister was sick, and I was very compelled by her story. And yet it really wasn't until I got sick that I thought, wait, you know, one sister with ovarian cancer would have been enough. But two sisters with rare cancers in their 40s, and then, in fact, I was treated by some amazing physicians in Boston, and I went to see a very well-known geneticist, and she just rolled her eyes. I mean, that the odds of us both having rare cancers in our 40 was just so small. So it becomes the predominance, the one story after another, that makes people really start to think about these issues.
Well, so a lot of people would counter that argument by saying, well, you know, cancer is a genetic disease. You and your sister, it must be in your genes.
Right. And, of course, there's always a genetic component to cancer, it is a disease of genetic mutation, but it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a strict family inheritance. I think that people talk about, or scientists tell us, that it's the genes times the environment equation. The genes load the gun, but environment pulls the trigger. So clearly my sister and I had a genetic weakness, maybe even a genetic weakness that made it hard for us to clear toxins. But I do believe that it's some combination of our genetic predisposition and our environmental exposures.
You know, another point you make in the book that I thought was really interesting was the impact of pollution on the communities, not in the sense of environmental exposures, that is the health itself, but how those exposures, how the pollution affected the economic life of Waukegan.
Waukegan lost about 30,000 jobs in the aftermath of the discovery of the pollution and many of the economic problems that we now think of as the Rust Belt going away, the end of American manufacturing in the Midwest. The interesting thing that happened in my town was that when the middle class manufacturing jobs left, there was a tremendous amount of flight from the community. In the absence of those people being there, huge numbers of Hispanics and Mexicans moved into town. Some of them are legal, some of them are not legal immigrants to this country. And that's created a whole problem of environmental justice, because the people now who have inherited the legacy of the pollution are the least capable in many ways of fighting it, either individually, as you know, within their own physical self, and also gathering together as a community. You can imagine, if you're new to this country, if you are don't speak the language and you are not a legal resident of this country, you're not actually going to get active in fighting years-old battles of pollution on the lakefront.
Making the connections there between the environment, economics, and the social dislocations.
Correct.
You write this book, Lake Effect, with the tremendous passion that does come from your personal experience and your personal tragedy. Was it hard to write the book?
Oh, it was impossibly hard to write the book. I was very sick, first of all, and I was took me about 5 years to write it, so I had a little office, and I would lay on the floor sometimes, and there were days when I cried all day, and there were days when I was sick all day. But I'm very, very pleased that I did it, and I hope that it's a helpful thing to other people. I really think that even though it's a difficult book, it's a hopeful book, that we can prevail against some of the things in our environment that I believe are linked to problems in our health. And I hope people will read it and enjoy it in that spirit.
Well, Nancy Nichols, thanks so much. Your book is Lake Effect, Two Sisters and a Town's Toxic Legacy. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nancy Nichols is an independent journalist, editor, and broadcaster. Among other publications, her writing has appeared in the Chicago Tribune, the New York Times Book Review, the Harvard Business Review, and The Nation. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox, or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.